Welcome to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are its traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's useful to have some notebook, paper, and pen so you can take notes during the show. For the last several months, I have been looking at The Web of Debt, which is a very important book related to the development of the banking system that rules our lives. It was written by Ellen Brown, and she has a website by the same name, Web of Debt. If you have not been looking at The Web of Debt, as I have suggested, you should get your hands on a copy of it. It's an amazing investigation into the foundational level of our whole financial life in America and also globally, which, if we understand, really impacts on almost every aspect of our life, individually, family, community, nationally, and internationally. I start my show with an important credit because the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in this program are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of attorney Ellen Brown. She has 11 books and scores of articles on the topic of debt. I highly recommend her book, The Web of Debt. And for those of you who have the time, you can go back and listen to the shows produced on this topic in the archives at www.kruufm.com under Life and Debt, specifically Life and Debt Web. What we have been doing in all of these shows is exploring the myths about money. And as a brief synopsis, we say that our money system is not what we have been led to believe. The creation of money has been privatized or taken over by a private money cartel. Except for coins, all of our money is now created as loans advanced by private banking institutions, including the private Federal Reserve. Banks create the principal, but not the interest, to service their money supply in the form of loans. To find the interest, new loans must continually be taken out, expanding the money supply, inflating prices, and robbing you of the value of your money. What we have been trying to do using The Web of Debt as a textbook is unravel the deception and present a crystal clear picture of the financial abyss towards which we are heading. But not all pessimism. We explore a workable alternative, one that was tested in colonial America and is grounded in the best of American economic thought, including the writings of Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and Abraham Lincoln. Our goal is financial security, our own and our nation's, and ultimately the entire world. So following along with the concepts we have been discussing can help reshape your thinking, and through you, a lot of other people who collectively can have an impact on the financial system. Let's start with a little review from the last show. The image of the puppet and the puppeteer has long been a popular metaphor for describing the money power pulling the strings of the government. Benjamin Disraeli, British Prime Minister from 1868 to 1880, said, "The world is governed by very different personages from what is imagined by those who are not behind the scenes." And obviously, all of us are not behind the scenes. Nathan Rothschild, who controlled the Bank of England after 1820, is quoted as declaring, "I care not what puppet is placed upon the throne of England to rule the empire on which the sun never sets." The man who controls Britain's money supply controls the British Empire, and I control the British money supply. End of quote. Patrick Carmack, co-author of the documentary video The Money Masters, uses the puppet metaphor to describe the transfer of power from the royal line of English Stuarts to the German royal house of Hanover in the 18th century. England was to trade masters, an unpopular King James II, for a hidden cabal of money changers pulling the strings of their usurper, King William III, from behind the scenes. This symbiotic relationship between the money changers and the higher British aristocracy continues to this day. The monarch has no real power but serves as a useful shield for the money changers who rule the city. In its 20 June 1934 issue, New Britain magazine of London cited a devastating assertion by former British Prime Minister David Lloyd George that Britain is the slave of an international financial bloc. This particular point is especially interesting because, in fact, the United States today is in exactly the same position as Britain was that we just described. We are also a slave of an international financial bloc, and as a result, the concept of freedom is extremely watered down because of the ability of the financial bloc to pull the strings of the government, the media, and the big businesses of both the United States and the world. Now, looking back to the English circumstance, where did these international financiers come from and how had they achieved their enormous power? Moneylenders had been evicted not only from England, but from other European countries. They had regrouped in Holland, where they plotted their return, but the English kings and queens staunchly resisted their advances. The king did not need to borrow money when he had the sovereign right to issue it himself. Again, by parallel thinking, this is precisely where the U.S. government could and should be, making our own money, not borrowing it. For a brief period in the 1500s, King Henry VIII relaxed the laws concerning usury when he broke away from the Catholic Church, but when Queen Mary took the throne, she tightened the laws again. The result was to seriously contract the money supply. But Queen Elizabeth I, Mary's half-sister, was determined to avoid the usury trap. She solved the problem by supplementing the money supply with metal coins issued by the public treasury. The coins were made of metal, but their value came from the stamp of the sovereign on them. This was established as a matter of legal precedent in 1600 when Queen Elizabeth issued relatively worthless base metal coins as legal tender in Ireland. All other coins were annulled and had to be returned to the mints. When the action was challenged in the highest court of the land, the court ruled that it was the sovereign's sole prerogative to create the money of the realm. What the sovereign declared to be money was money, and in England, it was treason for anyone else to create it. This decision was so detested by the merchant classes, the goldsmiths, and later the British East India Company, that they worked incessantly to destroy it. According to Alexander Del Mar, writing in 1895, he said, "This was done by undermining the crown and then passing the Free Coinage Act of 1666, opening the way for the foreign element to establish a new monarch and then reconstitute the money prerogative in the hands of a specific group of financiers, not elected, not representing society, and in large part, not even English." I just want to again point out the parallel here to what's going on in the United States today. Britain thrived with government-issued currency. tallies and coins until the king's sovereign authority was eroded by Cromwell's revolt in the mid-17th century. The middle classes, the traders, manufacturers, and small farmers, sided with Parliament under Cromwell, who was a Puritan Protestant. The nobles and gentry sided with the king, Charles I, son of James I, who followed the Church of England and the Anglican Church founded by Henry VIII. Although Henry had broken away from the Catholic Church, he advocated Catholic doctrine throughout his life and vigorously opposed the Protestants, who were more lenient than the Catholics toward usury and toward the Dutch moneylenders who practiced it. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Now back to the moneylenders. The moneylenders agreed to provide the funds to back Parliament on condition that they be allowed back into England and that the loans be guaranteed. That meant the permanent removal of King Charles, who would have repudiated the loans had he gotten back into power. Charles' recapture, trial, and eventual execution were duly arranged and carried out to secure the loans. Nasty business indeed, all for the sake of money and the control of money. After Cromwell's death, Charles's son, Charles II, was invited to return, but Parliament had no intention of granting him the sovereign power over the money supply enjoyed by his predecessors. When the king needed a standing army, Parliament refused to vote the funds, forcing him to borrow instead from the English goldsmiths at usurious interest rates. The final blow to the royal prerogative was the Free Coinage Act of 1666, as I mentioned before, which allowed anyone to bring gold or silver to the mint to have it stamped into coins. The power to issue money, which had for centuries been the sole right of the king, was transferred into private hands, giving bankers the power to cause inflations and depressions at will by issuing or withholding their gold coins. None of the earlier English kings or queens would have agreed to charter a private central bank that had the power to create money and lend it to the government. Since they could issue money themselves, they had no need for loans. But King William III, who followed James II, was a Dutchman and a tool of the powerful Wissel Bank of Amsterdam, which created the downfall of the sovereign prerogative permanently. The man who became King William III began his career as a Dutch aristocrat. He was elevated to Captain General of the Dutch forces and then to Prince William of Orange with the backing of Dutch moneylenders. This is really nothing different than the donations that politicians take during their campaigns, becoming beholden to the big corporations that donate the money. William's marriage was arranged to Princess Mary of York, eldest daughter of the English Duke of York, who reigned as James II of England from 1685 to 1688. James was then deposed, and William and Mary became joint rulers in 1689. William was soon at war with Louis XIV of France. To finance his war, William borrowed £1.2 million in gold from a group of moneylenders, whose names were to be kept secret. The money was raised by a novel device that is still used by governments today. The lenders would issue a permanent loan on which the interest would be paid, but the principal portion of the loan would not be repaid. The loan also came with other strings attached. They included the lenders were to be granted a charter to establish a Bank of England, which would issue banknotes that would circulate as the national paper currency. Also, the bank would create banknotes out of nothing, with only a fraction of them backed by coin. Banknotes created and lent to the government would be backed mainly by government IOUs, which would serve as the reserves for creating additional loans to private parties. An interest of 8% would be paid by the government on its loans, marking the birth of the national debt. And lastly, the lenders would be allowed to secure payment on the national debt by direct taxation of the people. Taxes were immediately imposed on the whole range of goods to pay the interest owed to the bank. The Bank of England has been called the mother of central banks. It was chartered in 1694 to William Paterson, a Scotchman who had previously lived in Amsterdam. A circular distributed to attract subscribers to the bank's initial stock offering said, "The bank hath benefit of interest on all monies which it, the bank, creates out of nothing." The negotiation of additional loans caused England's national debt to go from £1.2 million in 1694 to £16 million in 1698. By 1815, the debt was up to £885 million, largely due to the compounding of interest. The lenders not only reaped huge profits, but the indebtedness gave them substantial political leverage. The bank's charter gave the force of law to the fractional reserve banking scheme that put control of the country's money in a privately owned company with the capability of making money out of nothing. The Bank of England had the legal right to create paper money out of nothing and lend it to the government at interest. It did this by trading its own paper notes for paper bonds representing the government's promise to pay principal and interest back to the bank, the same device used by the U.S. Federal Reserve and other central banks today. After the Bank of England began issuing paper banknotes in the 1690s, the government followed suit by issuing paper tallies against future tax revenues. Paper was easily negotiable, making the paper tallies competitive with private banknote money. For the next century, banknotes and tallies circulated interchangeably, but they were not mutually compatible means of exchange. The banker's paper money expanded when credit expanded and contracted when loans were called or canceled, producing cycles of tight money and depression, alternating with easy money and inflation. These notes, unfortunately, appeared to be more sound than the government tallies because they were backed by gold. They appeared to be sound until a bank's customers got suspicious and all demanded their gold at the same time, when there would be a run on the bank and it would have to close its doors because it did not have enough gold to go around. That's the fractional reserve dilemma. Meanwhile, the government tallies were permanent money that remained stable and fixed. They made the banker's paper money look bad, so they had to go. The tallies had to go for another reason. King William's right to the throne was disputed, and the Dutch moneylenders who backed him could be evicted if the Catholics got back in and forbade moneylending again, which historically they did in England. To make sure that did not happen, the moneylenders used their new influence to discount the tallies as money and get their own banknotes legalized as the money of the realm. The tallies were called unfunded debt, while the Bank of England's paper notes were euphemistically labeled funded debt. Modern economic historians call this shift a financial revolution. According to a scholarly article published at Harvard University in 2002, tallies and departmental bills were issued to creditors in anticipation of annual tax revenues, but were not tied to any specific revenue streams, hence they were unfunded. When debt was funded, on the other hand, Parliament set aside specific revenues to meet interest payments, a feature that further enhanced confidence in lending to the government. Yet, what seems to have been overlooked is that until the mid-17th century, the tallies did not need to be funded through taxes since they were not debts. They were receipts for goods and services which could be used by the bearers in the payment of taxes. If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. So to repeat the concept, when the government is issuing its own money, that means it's not borrowing money from a private bank, even though it does not have gold or silver backing it. In other words, it's not funded. It didn't need to be funded through taxes since, in fact, the money is not a debt. They were receipts for goods and services which could be used by the bearers in the payment of taxes. This is really, as was said, the start of the financial revolution. In England, it was because the tallies were accepted and sometimes even required in the payment of taxes that they retained a stable value as money. Once again, the tallies were government-issued money. Before Cromwell's revolution, the king did not need to borrow because he could issue metal coins or wooden tallies at will to pay the bills. Jumping back to that Harvard article in 2002, the authors presented a chart showing that in 1693, 100% of the government's debt was unfunded or paid in government tallies. By 1720, over 90% of all government borrowing was long-term and funded. This, in a nutshell, was the financial revolution. In other words, the financial revolution transferred the right to issue money from the government to private bankers. Once more, no different than what is occurring in the United States. The government could issue its own money, but it does not. It borrows money and has to pay on the loan a substantial amount of interest to private bankers, which, by the way, is what we call the national debt. Well, back to England. In the end, the tallies met the same fate as the witches, death by fire. Remember, tallies were wooden sticks that had etched marks in them and were split. The government kept one half and the other half was a receipt, which was used as money. The medieval witches were mainly village healers whose natural herbs and potions competed with the male-dominated medical profession and church. Estimates of the number of women executed as witches for practicing natural herbal medicine and occult religion ranged from 40,000 to 9 million. Obviously, that's a huge gap, but it probably was quite large. The tallies were similarly the money of the people, which competed with the money of the usury bankers. In 1834, after the passage of certain monetary reform acts, the tally sticks went up in flames in a huge bonfire started in a stove in the House of Lords. In an ironic twist, the fire quickly got out of control and wound up burning down both the Palace of Westminster and the Houses of Parliament. I suppose that is as you sow, so shall you reap. To wit, for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. It all was a symbolic ending of an equitable era of trade with the transfer of power from the government to the bank. Popular acceptance of the banker's privately issued money scheme is credited to the son of a Scottish goldsmith named John Law, who has been called the father of finance. In 1705, Law published a series of pamphlets on trade, money, and banking, in which he claimed to have found the true philosopher's stone, referring to a mythical device used by medieval alchemists to turn base material into gold. Paper could be converted into gold, Law said, through the alchemy of paper money. He proposed the creation of a national paper money supply consisting of banknotes redeemable in specie, which is hard currency in the form of gold or silver coins, which would be officially recognized as money. Paper money could be expanded indefinitely and was much cheaper to make than coins. To get public confidence, Law suggested that a certain fraction of gold should be kept on hand for the few people who actually wanted to redeem their notes. The goldsmiths had already established through trial and error that specie could support about 10 times its value in paper notes, as we've discussed in the past. Thus, a bank holding $10 in gold coin could safely print and lend about $100 in paper money. This was the secret that the Chicago Federal Reserve said was discovered by the goldsmiths. A bank could lend about 10 times as much money as it actually had because a trusting public, assuming their money was safely in the bank, would not come to collect more than about 10% of it at any one time. Law planned to open a national bank in Scotland on the model of the Bank of England, but William Paterson, who held a charter for the Bank of England, had the plan halted in the Scottish Parliament. Law then emigrated to France. He had another reason for leaving the country. Notorious for escapades of all sorts, he had gotten into a duel over a woman, which he had won. But he had wound up with a murder conviction in England, so he skedaddled out of there. In France, Law was able to put his banking theories into practice when the French chose him to head the Banque Générale in 1716. Like the Bank of England, it was a private bank chartered by the government for the purpose of creating money in the form of paper notes. It was also in France that Law implemented his most notorious Ponzi scheme. Now, what's a Ponzi scheme? A Ponzi scheme is a form of pyramid scheme in which investors are paid with the money of later investors down the road. Charles Ponzi was an engaging Boston ex-convict who defrauded investors out of $6 million in the 1920s in a scheme in which he promised them a 400% return on redeemed postal reply coupons. For a while, he paid earlier investors with the money of later investors, but eventually he just collected without repaying. The scheme earned him 10 years in jail. That's the name given to the scheme, but it pre-existed his notorious use. The Mississippi Bubble involved exchange of a significant portion of French government debt for shares in a company that had a monopoly on trade with French Louisiana. The venture was called a bubble because most of the company's shares were bought on credit. In a huge speculative run, the shares went from about 500 French livres in 1719 to 10,000 livres by February 1720. They dropped back to 500 livres in September 1721. When the mania ended, the investors were completely broke and Law was again on the run. The Mississippi Bubble was short-lived because it was recognized as a sham as soon as more investors demanded payment than there were funds to pay them. Law's more enduring Ponzi scheme was the one that escaped detection, the Philosopher's Stone, by which a national money supply could be created from the government debt that had been monetized or turned into paper money by private bankers. The reason this sleight of hand never got detected was that the central bank never demanded the return of its principal. If the bankers had demanded the money back, the government would have had to levy taxes, rousing the people and revealing what was up the wizard's sleeve. But the wily bankers just continued to roll over the debt and collect the interest on a very lucrative investment that paid and continues to pay to this day like a slot machine year after year. This scheme became the basis of the banking system known as central banking, which remains in use today. A private central bank is chartered as the nation's primary bank and lends to the national government. It lends the central bank's own notes, printed paper money, which the government swaps for bonds, its promises to pay, and circulates as a national currency. The government's debt is never paid off, but is just rolled over from year to year, becoming the basis of the national money supply. Until the 20th century, banks followed the model of the goldsmiths and literally printed their own supply of notes against their own gold reserves. These were then multiplied many times over on the fractional reserve system. The bank's own name was printed on the notes, which were lent to the public and the government. Today, federal governments have taken over the printing, but in most countries, the notes are still drawn on independent central banks. In the United States, they are printed by the U.S. Bureau of Engraving and Printing at the request of the Federal Reserve, which buys them for the cost of printing them and calls them Federal Reserve notes. Today, however, there is no gold on reserve for which the notes can be redeemed. In short, the dollar is a fractal of a hologram, the reflection of a debt for something that does not exist. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life in Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.